building system that extended into the entire formation of the universe. And some of the choicest secrets of it were up to not too many years ago, perpetuated to the great university of Tsongkhapa Lhasa in Tibet. The present condition of the teaching is obscure, due to the present communist invasion of Tibet. But it is safe to say that the Tibetan Buddhists are already fully aware that one way to preserve your doctrine is to guard it and die with it. Or if you do, you will be reborn with it in a better day. It cannot perish. My universalism is that group, or that system of teaching, combining the Tantra Yoga of India with all of its study of esoteric currents in the human body, with Mantra Yoga, which has to do with the invocation and the use of the Bija letters, the great spell letters of magic, which will be equivalent almost to the old Kabbalism of Jews. It has to do with the contemplative universality of Vedanta. It borrows something from the esoteric practices of the Jains. And further than this, it has the secret which was perpetuated from the original apostolic descent of the immediate arhats of Buddha himself. This was the period, therefore, described in the great Buddhistic prophecy as the beginning of the age of the great interpretations. And out of these interpretations came the underlying concept set forth in the Book of Zen, which in turn forms the basis upon which the commentaries are written, which constitute the text of the Sutra Doctrine. This book, according to Madame Blavatsky, was written principally in symbols, and written in a strange kind of dialect to give us a few brief examples of these literal texts and the letters that she has in attempting to bring it into intelligible form. Yet what she is saying is nothing more or less than that which is set forth in stone in the great monument of the Buddha Madhura in Java, where the entire concept of the Mahayana, the great mystery of the cosmogony, the theology, and the anthropology are all set forth, to be finally summarized by the great unifying principle of esoteric psychology. The whole pattern began somewhere in the Trans-Himalayas. Now, if you wish to follow the tradition, and who knows how traditions begin, this esoteric system was revealed to mankind, or perhaps more correctly, locked within the consciousness of mankind, before humanity existed on this earth at all. The Kabbalists take the same point of view, declaring that Adam and Eve were taught the esoteric doctrine by an archangel while they were still in the Garden of Eden. That this esoteric teaching, therefore, was implanted in man, and that from previous waves of life, the elders, who are truly the great sages and arhats, the mysterious divine beings, the God-men, the wonderful heroes whose dim forms stand against the dark background of the prehistorical, all of these fit into a great system. For it was the Mahayana, through that magnificent symbolic work, the Logos Sutra, that suddenly caused the veil of the sky to be rent asunder, and man to stand in the presence of the vast cosmos of consciousness. The cosmos itself radiant with enlightened beings. An invisible order of life outnumbering man a million or a zillion times a million to one. A life whose the extent of which in time and space transcend imagination. A vast mass of existence, a glorious existence, more splendid than any vision of an ancient saint, more luminous and more transcendent than the apocalyptic vision of John on paper. Suddenly, the obscuration of matter seemed to break apart, and through this break came forth the radiance of the eternal. And Madame Blavatsky, deriving her studies of this symbolism, bases it very largely upon the descent of the great orders of celestial beings. So we have the great cosmogony of the secret doctrine arising from the mass of commentary, arising out of the visions of the first great Mahayana saint. Now there is one other point here that I think is somewhat valuable to us. The Mahayana did not stop writing scriptures 2,000 years ago, although the great sage Nagarjuna was presumably about contemporary with Christ, and some Eastern believers think that he was one of the wise men who visited from the East to the crib in Bethlehem. But this does not mean that Mahayana, or normal Buddhism, ended as far as Revelation is concerned at this time. It did not. The great saviors and patriarchs, and in the descent of the great Mahayana system, the sage and founder of Zen Dharma was the 29th. This great system kept right on producing these teachers, these patriarchs, who wrote scriptures, who wrote not only sacred books, but vast commentaries thereon. And so it has been estimated that at present time that the sacred books of Northern Buddhism consist of nearly 8,000 volumes, most of which are longer than the New Testament, and many longer than the Old Testament. That this literature is so vast that even the disciples of the great colleges at Lhasa were unable to read it all, and could not ponder upon its mysteries. Therefore, out of this vast literature, all of which has to do with the mystery of eternity and time, and the bringing forth of man out of the eternity, all of these systems that we know today are based upon one or two of these books, or a short summary of several of them. And the great book of the Northern Buddhists today is, of course, the Lotus Sutra. So from this study, we suddenly come face to face with a most amazing combination of values. We suddenly come into the realization of the operation of a great hierarchy of invisible power moving through the invisible manifestations in this world. That this hierarchy is actually the basis of nearly all theological systems concerning deities. And various forms of it, symbolism set up in it or for it, are to be found in the great classical religious systems, such as the Olympian deities of the Greeks and the ancient gods of Asgard in the Nordic mythology. Even in Central America, we find it. We find it wherever men have investigated, and at one time, Madame Blavatsky was in Santa Fe, New Mexico. She was also, for a short time, in California. But while in New Mexico, she investigated the secret rituals of the Indians, particularly the sand painters, and declared that their participation in the ancient tradition was completely valid, that they possessed this knowledge, that engaged, presumably, intuitively, from their natural psychism and from vigil, meditation, and the perpetuation of the ancient rites which we associate with the great race of the Mongolians to which the American Indian belongs. From the study of the secret doctrine and its comparison with the Prajna Paramita Sutra and other commentaries thereof, we are forced to assume that this work in many ways extended the insight which Madame Blavatsky had already attained, and certainly it was used by the teachers who instructed her, or was resorted to as a framework suitable to support the system which was to be made public by the secret doctrine. I think then that from the Mahayana we must assume that Madame Blavatsky did gain a great insight. She admits herself beyond question that at Tashi Rampung she examined the books of Mahayana, that she also must have received some instruction from those acquainted with these books, and that the letters of the Mahatmas and other references to the teachers that were peculiarly her own indicate that they also are in some instances almost quoting from the great Mahayana sutras. Then we have the foundation and perhaps the premises upon which the secret doctrine is based. Premises which have been assailed but not successfully in the West, and no one in the East would even try to assail. The first being that there has existed in the world since the beginning a science of salvation which clothed itself most anciently in religion, later took upon itself the vestments of theosophy, and must sometime form a union or a partnership also with science in order to vitalize, regenerate, and purify material knowledge. For unless material knowledge finally becomes enthroned by esoteric knowledge, man will destroy his civilization. The great problem always then is, does this esoteric knowledge actually exist? And here the debate has raged frantically, not only since the time of Madame Blavatsky, but wherever mysticism has been revealed to mankind. Unless this secret knowledge did exist, and has existed, already is a travesty. Unless we wish to assume that there never has been any knowledge but ours, Then we come face to face with the wisdom of the ancient sanctuaries. And within the last 50 or 60 years, it has dawned upon us that every useful art and science that we have today originated in the temple. That it was not a discovery by some modern thinker, but that a modern thinker took an ancient truth, formed it or applied it or directed it into some so-called appropriate practical challenge, and thereby gives us anything we want, from the combustion engine to the electric light bulb. These things are not new. They are adaptations of pioneer principles. It is now generally assumed that Numa, the first emperor of Rome, died as a result of an electric shock caused by the manufacturing of batteries. And we are also rather of the opinion at the present time that even the telephone, in a simple, basic, rudimentary way, but still functioning, is used in Egypt. Actually, all of us, particularly the great foundations of knowledge, mathematics, astronomy, music, medicine, art, literature, architecture, all of these were the sacred sciences of antiquity. And as we look upon the ruins in Central America, as we study the ancient monuments in the wilderness and deserts and fastnesses of China, as we examine also the great symbolic structures of India, Burma, Ceylon, Indonesia, also as we go into the great architectural canons of Vitruvius, the Builder of Rome, or study the great structures created by the Dionysian artificers in Greece and Syria 3,000 years ago, we have to face the simple fact that today many of their achievements cannot be equal. We do not know how they accomplished their purposes. But one thing we do know, that they were superlative masters of elements, and that this mastery came long before we assumed knowledge to exist. And every day we have to push back the mirror of human enlightenment by another million years or so. Discovery commands. The ones without writing writing when many of these facts were not available as they are today, pointed out definitely that there has been and always will be this great descent of secret knowledge, and that the importance of it today lies particularly in the great need to build some kind of an ethical substructure beneath the great overpowering superstructure of modern materialism. Unless we discover why we have to be right, we shall never be able to survive our own mistakes. Unless we learn what right is, unless we move faith from the uncertain foundations where it now lingers, to a belief in demonstrable truths, we are depriving ourselves of most of our great spiritual heritage. Ignorance of this kind is not necessary. It is not inevitable. It is simply the result of intentional blindness or reluctance to accept that which is contrary to systems of thinking which have already revealed that they are valid. Then Brunetsky's development of the esoteric tradition is in perfect harmony with the Mahayana ethical system. Mahayana has a unique place among the religions of the world in the fact that it has virtually no orthodoxy. Mahayana is not a system which is dedicated only to a revelation made 2,600 years ago in India and amplified 2,000 years ago in North Asia. Mahayana is regarded as a belief ever-growing, a great tree that can send forth new branches. And Mahayana is the only religion that accepts it as inevitable, that religions must evolve. So this is very, very important. Religions are not honorable because they are completely steadfast. They have to grow. Therefore, any generation can produce a new saint who can produce a new faith out of the same root. It is perfectly possible to interpret Mahayana in 100,000 ways, and you will still bring no censure upon yourself. The only thing that is necessary to maintain the integrity is that the interpretation, no matter what it is, must stand firmly upon the foundation of the great law of cause and effect. This is the only thing that is utterly required. Whatever it is, whatever you build, whatever you conceive, however you interpret it, whatever language or symbolism you put it in, it must be ethically and honestly true to the principles of truth. It must be honorable. It must be honest. It must be sincere. It must be lawful. And it must require man to save himself. From here on, it is up to the individual to find the ways of accomplishing these ends. Now, I think one of the ways in which we can observe the motion of Mahayana, and the way in which it did develop its incredible array of potential, is in the march of this faith across Asia in the last 19th century. Beginning in the highlands of the Himalayas, this great faith moved eastward and southward. By this time, Buddhism was comparatively extinct in India. That is, so far as its exoteric forms were concerned. It had again vanished into the great structure of Hinduism. But it had not failed to leave its indelible impress upon Hinduism, where it still lingers even today. The Mahayana, moving out into the great deserts, moved inevitably and irresistibly toward China. It moved along the great caravan routes. It established its great monasteries, its libraries, and carved the wonderful statuary in the grottoes of its ancient convent. It faced cliffs with images of the Enlightened One, and its monks and priests journeyed on, traveling in almost every direction, which carried them further and further into the areas of Eastern Asia. The great stream went downward into Java and Indonesia. It flowed into China and Korea. It passed along the great caravan routes of Turkestan. It crossed a part of what is now Russia. It also finally penetrated Tibet and Nepal. And everywhere it went, something happened. There was never a force exactly like it in the history of human experience. For wherever it went, nations blossomed like a rose. Wherever it went, peace, security, intelligence, education, morality, and ethics began to develop. It went to nations that were cannibalistic and converted them, not only away from cannibalism, but to become vegetarians. It went into every area where they had a civilization and touched this civilization with a magic wand. And out of its great motion eastward, there rose from the mysterious splendor of the unrolled pageantry of the Lotus Sutra, the magnificent art series, painting, sculpting. It gave us printing. It gave us one great discovery after another. It gave us our first hospitals, our first almshouses. It was the first to pass laws for the protection of the old and the needy. It gave guardianship to children who were orphaned. It established hospitals for men and animals. Everywhere it went, it did something that had never happened before in the history of the world. It brought a transcendent dedication to something that was sublime, something invisible. And it dedicated all these people to a desperate effort to trace invisible things, the splendor of this invisible pattern. And we find it reaching through China in the great schools of Buddhism. We find it touching onto the mainland and then skipping across to the island of Japan, where Zen and Shingon and Tendai, where they Yoga sects, and the Hongganjis, and the Nichiren, and the ancient beliefs produced and flowered into a great artistry, magnificent fabrics, the tea ceremony, literature, flower arrangement, wonderful gardens, magnificent buildings with their pitched roofs, all kinds of beauty. Beauty which has become proverbial to us, which we have come to expect, and with this, a powerful introspection. There are today, of course, in Japan, two sects that are almost exactly the equivalent of the old Trans-Himalayan Kalachakra school of the Yogacarya persuasion, and that is the Tendaishin and the Shingonshin. Here are the secret teachings again. The rituals given as they were at Delphi and in Egypt, or in Lesus, or in Samothrace, nearly 3,000 years ago. Here disciples are initiated with the same trials that we read about, but were not believed to have existed in this world for 2,000 years. The same rites. The same ritual, the same mysterious mantras and mudras, the same as desperate effort to unite man's consciousness with the infinite life of this. Here we have all of the meditation systems, the study of the chakras of the spine, the studies of breath and the yoga, bound together in a very deep and strange abstruse religious patterns represented in art by the great mandala, for symbolical pictures of the esoteric patterns of existence. Shingon and Tendai are an expression of the same mystery that moved out across the face of Asia. In their paintings and symbols, in their ancient scrolls and writings, are the same symbols and the same elements that were found in the scrolls of Zen. Here we have the imagery brought from Tibet. Here we have the ancient teachings of Padmasambhava and Sattva and Tsongkhapa. Living today as they. Still followed in the sanctuaries and cloistered groves of the ancient mountains. Here we have again the pagodas of the Iron Tower, where Nagarjuna received the secret doctrine from the guardian keepers, the Nagas or the Serpent Kings. It is all still alive. It isn't something that belongs to other ages. There is no doubt whatever in my mind that Madame Blavatsky found alive in her day. It had to have been, or it could not be alive now. She found, therefore, in her searching, a religion so strangely universal, yet so incredibly scientific, that it was the final reconciliation of these two great systems of knowledge. And she was convinced that this was the eternal teaching. This was the old wisdom which Muhammad prayed might be revealed to him as he fasted and meditated in the cavern of Mount Hira. He might know the primitive religion of mankind, the eternal faith. The faith that is buried in all other faiths, just as the life of the universe is buried in all forms. The faith that must come forth out of its grave, just as sure as the life in man must come out of the bodies, which now obscure. This primordial, eternal pattern of knowledge, that we wish to assume that it was originally a great psychological system, which whether it was locked as an archetype in the consciousness of man and the fashion, whether truly it is the hard doctrine, as the Mahayana is called, in which Buddha initiated his disciples, the mystic or mysterious Saptapana cave or cavern, the house of the seven rooms, the heart. Whatever we wish to assume, the secret doctrine, as propounded by H.P. Blavatsky, is dedicated to the existence of this esoteric doctrine that has been served and guarded and perpetuated since the beginning of man's existence, and before that was preserved in superior regions for the glory of angels and for the wisdom of the gods themselves. That all of this great pattern, and it has been set forth, in part at least, in such writings as the Dabar Zohar, the Book of Splendors, the Sefer Yetzirah, the Book of the Formations, the Sefer Apophis, the Book of the Revelations. These writings tell something of it. But what religion never achieved after it was finally separated from the temple mysteries was this reconciliation of all knowledge in the production of the perfect science. This was the alchemical mystery. This was the hermetic secret. It is this that has been intimated, has suggested, implied everywhere in the world. Madame Blavatsky expounded as a living thing in northeastern Asia. And here she resolved to form these commentaries to prove not only that the eastern wisdom served the east, but that so far as modern western knowledge was correct, it supported the esoteric tradition. And where it did not support the esoteric tradition, there was great probability that the Western knowledge was wrong. And many things which she said concerning this in the 80s and early 90s have come to pass. We have been forced to revise a great many of our opinions on these matters. We cannot probably at this time attempt to restore the original texts that she used in Asia. They are referred to, they probably exist and are known. Documentary evidence has been found and is available, proving conclusively Madame Blavatsky's presence at Panchalambu as the guest of the Panchamwan. Also, evidence is coming to light constantly to support various statements she made concerning the sources of her esoteric information. In all parts of Asia, even today, There is a general belief in senons or saints. These senons are the Mohan of Buddhism, the Arhats of India. They are the Rinkan of the Japanese group. They are the wandering saints who never die. They are the ones who are appointed by Gautama Buddha to remain in the world as the teachers of mankind until the advent of the Maitreya Buddha. Therefore, he is sometimes represented accompanied by them. These are the mysterious sages of the Jade Mountains of China and Korea, the Diamond Mountains of Korea particularly. These are the mysterious Taoist genii, the sages of supernatural power who perform the same miracles that were accredited to the apostles of Christ and to the wonder workers of other ancient religions. These also are the great yogis of India, the rishis. These are the ones that everywhere among ancient peoples are known to have existed. They are also found in Europe in the alchemical tradition. The chief and most important of them being Arias Atista, the sage who must walk the earth until the second coming of Christ, in order that the arts and mysteries might not die. Everywhere in legend we have in the Chinese annals, there are many accounts of these sages attending the persons of emperors, but who come from their mysterious hiding places to mingle with men. Everywhere in the East, the existence of these sages is taken for granted even now. And there are records of the appearance of these mysterious beings down to the middle of the 19th century. Mahavadasis Mahatma, about which there has been perhaps more controversy than on any other aspect of her teaching. This teaching, this concept is of no amazement anywhere in Asia. It is no amazement among the American Indians, because these people were critically aware of the ones who lived in two worlds, who stood with one foot upon the earth and the other in heaven, who came in the answer to prayer, who appeared in vision, who sent their minds across the world. The visions of these beings and what they have done have been found in Tibet in comparatively recent years. Sir Francis Young husband found them there when he went to Tibet in 1903. The actual presence of these people is assumed, and disciples within the last 25 or 30 years report the same thing, namely that such beings do exist. And according to a fairly well-authenticated report, two of these teachers actually lived for a time in New York City. We can say what we want to, we cannot objectively produce them at any time to answer the doubts or skepticisms of unbelievers or to act the part of the Lord in the presence of the doubting Christ. But in Asia, there is no doubt. All of the system of gurus is based upon this. So these gurus are simply the agents of the great teachers. All yoga is based upon this. For all these systems, the final instruction has to be given not by the more common teachers visible in the world, but by preparing the disciples to depart to the abode of the great teachers, who alone can bestow the greater mysteries. And in a recent publication of the Theosophical Society on the life of Dhammadhar, this young man is advanced as an example of one who was called into the highlands of Central North Asia in order to receive further instruction when he could go no longer or to proceed no further in his ordinary search for knowledge. But there is no question about this. Now we may say that there is a question. We may say that as machine guns exist, the cobalt dioxide is not sleeping in its tomb at Corazon, simply waiting to awaken again with the coming of the Maitreya. We may not believe it when they say that every year they change his garments, although it's supposed to have been dead for nearly 1,200 years. And they have to change his garments, because each year they are worn out. To these people, the great sage is not only still alive, but has the power to project himself at his own will. Everywhere among these people, such accounts persist. And there is a very interesting account relating to the Rajput princes of the state of Jaipur in India. Jaipur being, of course, the state from which one of the Mahatmas related to the production of the secret doctrine is said to have come from, that he was a prince of Jaipur. In Jaipur, there has been a mysterious account for years, for centuries, of the esoteric background of the princes of the families of Rajputana, the Rajas, Maharajas of Jaipur, have been considered magicians, wonderers, men who go to sleep in their graves and wake up 1,000 years later and run the nation again. Well, this is all strength, respectively. Something we don't want to even dare to believe, because it would be so inconsistent with our acceptances. And Madame Blavatsky was first perfectly aware of this problem herself, and did not wish at any time to build her philosophy primarily upon any form of miraculous service. We did not want our followers to develop a group of hallucinations and believe that they were wandering around with masks. Nothing was further than their mind. But they were part of our own story, and as such, directly included them. But the main purpose behind this inclusion is simply to point out that the wisdom system has endured, that the mysterious society of the White Lotus has not died, that Northern Buddhism's invisible government of the earth has not died, and that whether the Western man is aware of it or cares or is concerned about it or not, that however, if we think carefully, it better be true. There had better be a plan somewhere. There had better be some pattern or seed which man cannot outwit. There had better be a justice that he cannot destroy. There had better be a purpose, for he is unable to find one for himself. Furthermore, there had better be answers to some of the great questions of our time. For nearly every line of knowledge that we possess today is going into bankruptcy for lack of further answers. It's going as far as we could. But we need the mystery of the actual knowledge, the Buddha of infinite unity. We need the secret help. And in Mahayana, the secret help is tied into the very great picture of man's redemption. We better find the secret of peace. This all lies in the mysteries of the Northern Dust. we have better seen what it is in this world of a great plan beyond our own, as suggested by the radiant light hovering over the mysterious island city of Shambhala. We have better hope that the Lord might say that will come, as in the banners of Mongolia we found his image with one foot upon the earth, to signify that he shall come forth and keep the promise of the Krishna of the Bhagavad Gita. There had better be this mysterious underlying wisdom. And it is very interesting that while we cannot all understand these things, and perhaps very few of us can ever understand much about it, that there is a tremendous moral force behind the simple conviction that there are answers, and that the great teachers of mankind have had the answers, and that they have also understood each other, and that beneath the surface of knowledge as we know it is this secret science of salvation. This science, you know, which has always been regarded as hidden behind the great snow mountains of the North, the wonderful world of truth that lies beyond the sorrows of mankind, the wonderful presence that comes to us inwardly and brings us to eternity. If this is not merely a series of vagrant happenings, but is tied together in a great pattern, then this fact has set forth in the Teacher Doctrine perhaps constitutes the basic premise of Madame Blavatsky's work. Well, I close up for this evening, so we'll see you in the next one.